This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The 48-hour film festival features the work of 24 local filmmakers and nearly 200 artists in a collection of short films shot earlier this month in just 48 hours. The resulting films will be screened beginning tomorrow at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. We hear more about that later in the program. But as long as we've just mentioned Lunis McGlowan, a broadcast pioneer and composer-lyricist whose name is on that theater, let's talk about some other Charlotte broadcast pioneers, those that will make up the inaugural class of inductees into the new Charlotte Broadcast Hall of Fame. 11 inductees are on a list that is literally a who's who of Charlotte broadcasting. People who were pioneers, who broke new ground and created an industry. We're going to talk about these people and their accomplishments. But first, let me just read you the names. Grady Cole, Charles Crutchfield, Betty Feaser, Earl Gluck, the Reverend Billy Graham, Stan and Sis Kaplan, Charles Kuralt, Doug Mays, Chatty Hattie Leeper, Larry Sprinkle, Bill Walker. The Charlotte Broadcast Hall of Fame is the creation of Central Piedmont Community College and will be housed at WTVI PBS Charlotte Studios, which of course is operated by CPCC. And here to talk about this first class of inductees is a man who knew many, perhaps all of them, Jim Babb, who started in broadcasting in 1955 at WBTV. He also spent time at WBT Radio and is now Executive Vice President and COO of Bayhackle Communications, which operates WCCB-TV. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here.
Sis Kaplan is one of the inductees, along with her husband Stan, the late Stan Kaplan. Together, they created the legendary 61 Big Ways, a station that was that fundamentally changed radio in Charlotte forever when it took on what was then the predominant powerhouse, WBT, and drove them into the ground.
I've waited for
17 years to say that. Anyway, at least for a while you did.
You appeared to enjoy saying it very much.
Yes, I did. Welcome. One of the people who helped make Big Ways the success that it was during the 60s and 70s, you now know as longtime Channel 36 WCNC-TV weatherman Larry Sprinkle. He, too, is an inductee, and he's here this morning, too. You look very sleepy, Larry.
I mean, the 1:30 a.m. alarm clock and the thunderstorm last night.
Yeah.
That I predicted, by the way. I finally got it right.
Finally.
Our chin's not bad, Larry.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Right, and I am personally thrilled to have Chatty Hattie with us. Hattie Leeper was the first African-American woman on the air in North Carolina at WGIV, a legendary African-American station. She started there in 1948, went on the air in the 1950s. She's also a member of the North Carolina Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame and the Black Radio Hall of Fame, and she authored the book Chatty Hattie, The Legend.
Yes.
Good to see you. How are you?
I am fine, Mike. How are you?
I'm terrific. Let me begin with Jim, and we'll get to each of you individually here, but how do you fit into this Charlotte Broadcasters Hall of Fame? Did you help pick the inductees? Are you running the place?
Yeah, I was an original member of the committee that started out a few years ago and then kind of went on the sidelines for a while and then got reinvented when CPC and WTVI took over the program, and so I've been involved with nominees. I'm happy to say that not only did I nominate Hattie, but her cohort, Jean Eugene Potts, and Francis Fitzgerald, who was the owner, founder, and a real visionary. So that's how I got involved and come behind the scenes.
How were these nominees chosen?
Pardon me?
How were the nominees chosen?
Well, it was chosen by virtue of getting as many people as we were aware of. There are approximately 30 or 40. There could be 130 or 40. Where do you start? So we started back with 1922 and moved forward and basically came with the founding of the television age in Charlotte. And that was with the WBTV in 1949. Of course, as you mentioned, Hattie was on WGIV in 1948 with my good friend David Wright. I listened to him all the time. So we just kind of went back to the 40s because Grady Cole, of course, went back into the 30s, and he was a legend that everybody knew about. But that's we just had a starting point and ended up with 30-plus nominees in the first class.
We're going to go through this chronologically. That's the best way to do it, I think. In Charlotte, the broadcasting here began with a radio station called 4DX. It was on the air in 1920, ultimately became WBT, which signed on the air as WBT on April 10th, 1922.
Right. I was not here then.
You weren't. No. There's some question about whether WBT can claim to be the first or the second radio station in the country. KDKA.
Well, it's kind of like the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. It's up to others to disprove. So I remember
first in the South, though, definitely, right?
Certainly first in the South. Yes.
Okay. First, as we used to say, first in the Southeast and still leading the way. That's what we used to say. It was the brainchild of one of the inductees, Earl Gluck. He and two others started 4DX, I don't know which one it is now, in a chicken coop behind a house at 2632 Mecklenburg Avenue.
I had come to Charlotte right after World War I, and having been a ham before the war, I was interested in getting a ham station on the air again, and met Mr. Laxton and another gentleman, Mr. Bunker, in a store downtown in Charlotte where we were all interested in buying some materials to rebuild our ham station. At that time, Mr. Laxton told us of a new high-powered vacuum tube being built by General Electric, and he thought he might be able to get one of them, and if he could get it, he suggested we combine our efforts and build a radio telephone transmitter.
That's Earl Gluck in a documentary put together that we stole from WBT for one of their anniversary programs. And as he mentioned, he started it with two other guys, Fred Lasseter and Fred Bunk. Why aren't they inductees?
Well, as I say, you had to start at a certain point, and who's to say they won't be inductees next year or the year after?
Now, they started at 100 watts, eventually became 50,000 watts. They would be bought by CBS later and become part of the Jefferson Standard Insurance Company. And then Earl Gluck would go on to start WSOC.
TV.
TV.
Correct.
How did that happen?
Well,
traitor?
The Jones family owned it, but he left BT, and he was one of the founders of WSOC-TV as well.
Okay. And because WBT was the first station in the Southeast, they were a powerhouse. In those early days, from the 20s until, 1970 or 80, they were everywhere. And in the 20s and 30s and 40s, because there were so few stations on the air in the country, they blanketed much of the eastern part of the country. And they brought on, in the early days, a man who would be the morning host of WBT for over 30 years. And his name was Grady Cole.
Good morning. This is Grady Cole, and it's WBT Charlotte, North Carolina. We begin our new day of broadcasting with the recordings and transcriptions here in the heart of the Carolinas, God's country. Let me say to you, friends, wherever you may be listening, it is now 14 and a half minutes past 5 o'clock Eastern United States time. Wherever you live, we will grant you that's the finest place in the world to live. But if you ever make a change, the next best place to live is in Carolina, USA.
They don't make them like that anymore, do they?
No. We could fill this show and several more with stories about Grady. I'll give you a couple quick ones. Grady drove the business office crazy. He would not cash his checks. He would have 6, 7, 8 months' worth of checks. And these were weekly checks back in those days. And it was also said that he could have been elected governor of both states at the same time, North and South Carolina. But Grady had a propensity to be, what shall we say, long-winded. So if he stopped you in the hall at the station, it was difficult to get away from him. And so if somebody saw that you were talking to Grady, they'd go and have you paid. You have an immediate call. I once took him to lunch with a client at the old City Club, which was in the corner of 4th and South Tryon back in those days. And he was on, did a farm show until 12:15. So we got there about 12:45. I left at 4 o'clock. He was still with the client. Wow. The client called me and said, I'll buy anything that you have to sell. Just don't bring Grady with you.
You know, you mentioned how powerful he was in terms of being able to be elected governor of both North or South Carolina. But he also shamed North Carolina into building roads, did he not?
Yes, he was very influential from a political point of view. And obviously, he was heard all over the Carolinas. In fact, he was heard in Cuba and New Hampshire as well. But in any event, he was very influential, and he didn't mind speaking up.
Charles Crutchfield is one of the other inductees that a lot of people may not know because he was primarily behind the scenes for much of his career, although he started as an announcer and is credited with helping to create the legendary Briar Hoppers musical organization, which held sway on both radio and television for years in this city, and he helped birth WBTV. So you worked with Charles Crutchfield. I met him on numerous occasions, and he struck me as a visionary. These are people who made this business up from whole cloth.
He was not only a visionary, he had courage. It took a lot of courage to recommend to an insurance company to bring the first television station to the Carolinas because it wasn't going to be profitable for several years. Of course, he knew that. But it took a lot of courage as well as vision. He did that. And he was a very spectacular man in all ways. The neatest, most organized person I've ever worked with, and just a fabulous human being on top of it. I'll give you, he was also the most impatient person I've ever known. And when he called your office, his secretary called now, Marjorie Miller, and said, Mr. Crutchfield, I'd like to see you. She expected for you to be walking in the door about the time her phone hit the cradle. And if not, you know, she'd be calling you back. So once I was on a phone call literally with a client, she called. I said, well, I'm on the phone with a client. I'll be there as quick as I can. She called about three times. So I walked into his office. He had a neat desk. He only had one piece of paper on it at a time. And so he looked at me and said, where in the heck have you been? Except he didn't say heck. And I said, well, I was on the phone with a client. I sat down. I said, besides that, you didn't have anything to do anyhow. He looked at me, and I thought he was going to reach across the desk and grab me by my lapel and pull me across the desk. Instead, he broke up laughing and said, you're right.
You know, he helped make up the business as he went along, and he was responsible, I think, for recognizing and bringing a lot of people along who had a tremendous amount of talent, particularly on television. And people on TV have a broad reach because TV went everywhere, and there was only one station at the time, and that was Channel 3. One of those people was a legend and continues to be a legend in this market, and that is Betty Feaser.
Time now for new ideas in creative homemaking. Crafts and skills in better living for you. Today's woman. Now here's one of the nation's top television authorities, Betty Feaser.
Hello. Our show for today begins right here with the lesson in how to make a scarf, which can open up to go around your head for a wind cover or a rain cover for your hair. And then also it may be used as a scarf around your neck. If you'd like to make one of these, be sure you have your pencil and paper ready so I can give you dimensions and tell you just exactly how to go about doing it. Let's talk about fireplace tapers today, another good gift item that's very inexpensive since it's made from newspapers. Your children will enjoy making this and giving it to an older person, perhaps, for Christmas. We'll begin a series this week on instant batik. Now, batik is a very old process. It's been done in India and in the Far East for a long time. But let me show you a quicker way to do it today.
She's talking to the camera, and she is not using a teleprompter. And she did this. She's mentioned three or four things they're going to do today, and she did this show 5 days a week. I'm exhausted just listening to her. Amazing.
She was a consummate pro. I agree with you. You were giving the signal about wrapping up earlier. You just give her 5 seconds and she wrapped up. She was unbelievable.
We'll come back and talk more about Betty, and then we're going to talk to Chatty Hattie. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte School of Law, offering a fully online corporate compliance certificate program for both lawyers and non-lawyers, accepting RSVPs for a lunch and learn session September 9th and 23rd, info at charlottelaw.edu. You may have noticed that hookah and vape smoking lounges are popping up all over town. As a former tobacco state, you might find this odd, since we've been discouraging the use of tobacco for some time now and literally have locked people out of smoking in public places, but not anymore because these hookah places are popping up and they're being frequented by younger and younger people. So we're going to look into the phenomenon and find out more about these places and about the health risks, if there are any, involved in e-cigarettes tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Hillary Clinton has turned over to federal authorities a server containing thousands of emails from her time as Secretary of State. What's in the emails and how the controversy is affecting her presidential campaign.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Charlotte Broadcast Hall of Fame, which invites its first inductees into the fold on Friday. It'll be housed at WTVI PBS Charlotte. It's part of CPCC. Jim Babb is with us, the COO and VP of Bayhackle Communications. Sis Kaplan, founder of Big Ways, Larry Sprinkle, a personality there, and Chatty Hattie Leeper, one of the major personalities in this market at WGIV. We'll talk to her in a second. Betty Feaser, we just heard from Betty Feaser. It is hard to explain to people today just how powerful and influential and loved Betty Feaser was.
She was a consummate pro, but more importantly than that, she was just a spectacular human being. And you're right, everybody loved her. It's one of the hardest things I've been through when she contracted cancer and, of course, later died from it. She fought it hard. Mm-hmm. But she was just a spectacular human being. Of course, she was a great cook, and she always had great things on her show, which made the crew, floor crew, happy. They were well-fed, and they brought on the problem of obesity starting back when she was on there. You mentioned Crutch and talent. He had an unbelievable eye for talent, and the addition of being a great manager and leader, he brought Jim Patterson in, Alan Newcomb, Clyde McLean, of course, Doug Mays, just a whole host of great talents. Pat Lee was another great talent on our staff at that time. But yeah. Betty Feaser was as good a pro as I've ever known her work
but
with.
But she wasn't the only woman making inroads in broadcasting in Charlotte. Chatty Hattie Leeper was doing that over at WGIV. Is it true that you fell into this by mistake, Chatty, in terms of being on the air?
Almost. Actually, you refer to it in today's times as having an internship.
Okay.
People understand that better, but actually, back in that day, it was just luck, that it happened. I had a mentor by the name of Junior Gene Parts, who was a principal at that time, and he would help me with my homework so I could stay on the honor roll in school. And then he said, "You're a smart little girl." He said, "How old are you?" I said, almost 14, and I was, Bobby socks, pigtails, and all that during that era, and uh-huh. Penny loafers,
Right.
He said, "Well, if you walk down to the radio station, I'll help you to learn how to put the music in alphabetical order. Would you like to do that?" I said, "Alphabetical order." And, we just had a bond. He was like a father figure to us all there at the station because, we were younger than he. You had Rockin' Ray Gooding. You had Joy Boy, who is deceased also. And, of course, all of that clan has already made the transition, have already gone on. And
describe that station for us. What happened? You're Chatty Hattie, and back then, black radio, the best of them, the mm-hmm. guy, people on the air, mm-hmm. rhymed everything.
Exactly. And what they're doing now is called rap music. We were rapping and didn't even know it back then.
Can you give me an example of what it might have sounded like, what you might have sounded like on
Okay, Mike, I don't mind telling you that. That's easy to do. I would just hit the airways and say, "Hi, world," real sexy voice. "This is your girl, Chatty Hattie, talking to you. Come on, let me talk to you." And you would charm, the microphone, and you're sitting there, you got to be crazy to talk and smiling at a microphone, But you're talking to millions and millions of people. So you just enjoy just the fascination of it, and it gets in your blood, and especially after you get a paycheck, and you say, "I got paid for sitting talking. Oh, boy, this is a good job."
In your book, you talk about you and your colleagues having the talent and I understand this, but others don't, the talent to talk up a record. In other words, you're talking over the intro and you stop talking the instant the vocal begins. Now, that has become verboten in broadcasting today. People don't like that. But back then, they loved it, and people loved doing it.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But we call that having precision timing. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was. You knew exactly when to stop talking, because you don't talk and the music is over and the voice on the record is coming up. You don't talk over somebody else talking. That's
right.
Rude.
Yeah.
That's rude. We knew how to time it. I mean, we were on it and never late going on the air. That's a no-no. You know, you just, that's unheard of. You get fired for that pink slip. You can't be late. And don't care who just died in your family, you got to go on there and smile. You're so happy.
Show business, baby.
Show must go on.
Mm-hmm. So that was a very important radio station, doing some very important things for its time in its day. So did you understand that at the time, or was it just going to work every day for you?
It was more or less going to work every day. See, then we didn't have all these cabbage heads, I call it, you know, ego trips and all that. We were just thankful to be able to do this, you know, and never dreamed that you would last forever and ever.
You came along at a time, like I did, when people who wanted to be in this business would hang around. Mm-hmm. I mean, as kids, as teenagers. I remember sitting in the studio with Ed Walker and Willard Scott in Washington, which watching the Joy Boys in Washington do their show every night, just because they let me hang around.
Right.
I don't see that happening much today anymore. Is it because the business has changed? It's not so much fun. We're not in the business to entertain anymore. What's the difference, do you think?
Well, to me, the difference is, during that time, you were the star. You were the superstar. You were the Michael Jackson, you know? And everybody wanted to be a part of you. You'd had an entrepreneur following you everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk in the supermarket pushing your buggy, getting your groceries, somebody's humming a song behind you as you walk because they want to be discovered.
By you.
Know?
You. Because back then you could play.
You could
choose
that.
Some of your own music.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You were powerful.
Absolutely.
One of the other stations in town that came along later that really, 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 and I can't overstate this, changed the whole nature of broadcasting in this town was when Sis and Stan Kaplan moved from Chicago to Charlotte. And I'll let one of the other inductees into the Hall of Fame introduce you to their radio station. Here's former WSSC-TV news anchor Bill Walker.
Back in the mid-60s, the Charlotte radio market changed forever when Big Waves went on the air. The owners, Sis and Stan Kaplan, brought big city rock radio to Charlotte, and things haven't been the same since.
Here's Jack Gale to ruin your breakfast.
This is Jack Gale saying, whether you have your own teeth or not, keep smiling.
61 Charlotte, W-A-Y-S.
I love jingles. I can't tell you. Sis Kaplan. Sis Kaplan is here.
I do, too.
You came to town. You and Stan blew this market up. Was that your intent when you came to town and started Big Ways?
Yes.
Did you know how you were going to do it?
You want to see the shrapnel?
Did you know how you were going to do it?
Yes. We had a plan, and we executed the plan, and we got talent that could perform and be fantastic, like Larry Sprinkle. And one of the fortunate things that happened to us very soon after we got here is Jim Babb left radio and went to television, which was a great thing for us.
Modesty prevents me from elaborating.
So why Charlotte? You were in Chicago. Why Charlotte?
To be honest with you, I had never heard, when we found out about the station, the only thing I had ever heard of in North Carolina was Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And we were about to, we were actually, Stan was with a station in Boston, and I, right after we got married, and I was working for an agency there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten a job at Wide World of Sports in New York, mm-hmm. and we were looking for an apartment in New York when the station came on to our minds and where someone called us. And I came down here and did the due diligence and discovered that it was a fantastic, a growing market. My mother was a little concerned. She thought they were going to burn crosses on our front yard every morning or every night.
We thought about it.
Yeah. Which, frankly,
you want to walk that back? Right. You want to walk that back, Jim?
In those days, Charlotte was a very, very different city.
Yes.
Fortunately, it has changed a great deal. But yes, we had a plan, and we executed all of the plan. And part of the reason we brought news onto the station as strongly as we did is I was down here, and there was an election, and it was when Fred Alexander was about to be elected to the city council, the first black man mm-hmm. since Reconstruction days. And if you'll excuse me, BT was still in religion while this election was being decided, and we thought, we're going to also put together a news department here. And it worked.
You this is an AM station, although it's 610 on the dial. At that frequency, you get out. You cover the area. At least you did back then. 610 is a little challenged right now. But back in the day, 77 WABC was the big powerhouse top 40 station. It was WLS in Chicago, WFI in Philadelphia, CKLW in the Motor City, WOWO in Wayne. And you were right up there with them here in little old Charlotte at the time. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that we decided we were going to pay for and get good talent. And we did. Larry is a perfect example, and many of our people who were on the air later, left and went to bigger markets.
Now, Jack Gale was the morning personality for
yes.
a very long time, and then Bob Murphy came in, and he became a powerhouse in
right.
this market and others after he left here. Murphy in the morning, Larry Sprinkle, you were a major part of Murphy
yes.
in the morning.
A very major part.
Were you at the station before Murphy? Or is
Oh, yeah, I was there. I came in 1973, early 73. And at that time, Jay Thomas was the morning guy at the station.
This is the Jay Thomas on television.
The Jay Thomas, the same guy who went on TV, Mork and Mindy, movies and everything.
Right.
And he and I worked together. We did a two-man show together, and I was just a second banana for him for the insanity that he had.
Well, most people know you now as the weatherman.
A lot of people have no idea I was ever in radio.
No idea that you can do all of these voices. How many characters do you think you did over the course of Murphy in the Morning and working with Jay Thomas?
One, two, with Jay, it was the characters. He would just go, okay, we have, just off the cuff, he'd go, and we got Frank Stevens. Frank, how you doing today? I'm Frank Stevens. And he would just instantly come up with a character.
Uh-huh.
Murphy, we planned it out, so it could be, hi there, my name is Jimmy Carter, the President of the United States of America. How you doing, Murphy? It could be a president. It could be,
oh, it's so good to be here. It's Michael Jackson.
It could be.
I think you just lost your job on television.
Probably so. I probably did.
Not only did he do it on the air, but he did this off the air. I mean, he would send Stan, who was the big sales guy, he would send Stan out on a phony call somewhere.
I was always in trouble.
Always.
Now, I know that you had a lot of different skits and running things that happen on the Murphy in the Morning show, but one of them was a spoof of the Jim and Tammy Baker PTL Club. You called yours the Pass the Loot Club.
61 Big Ways. Live from Charlotte, North Carolina, it's the Pass the Loot Club. Yes, the Pass the Loot Club, spreading the word to millions each year and receiving millions by return mail. And now,
now, here's the popular host of the Pass the Loot Club, ladies and gentlemen, Brother Bill.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to yet another meeting of the Pass the Loot Club. This is Brother Bill, so happy to be back here on the Murphy in the Morning Show once again, and so happy for the opportunity to reach into your pockets once again. Oh, pass the loot.
Pass the loot.
You know, today is a very exciting day in Pass the Loot Club history.
That's right.
And I'll tell you why.
Tell me why.
Some of you may have noticed a large balloon-like object floating over the skies of Charlotte yesterday. Well, friends, it's not a bird. It's not a plane. It's not a weather balloon. No, it's the all-new Pass the Loot Club Mobile Donation Center. Yes, now you can make a donation right in your own community as the Pass the Loot Club's Mobile Donation Center sets down near your home.
Now, you know, that was, for the time, incredibly subversive.
It was. I mean, and the reaction we got from down in Fort Mill was not the most positive, although Stan and Seth said, we gave them the opportunity to respond to anything that we did.
Right.
The floor was open. The door was open. Come on in. They never replied, never responded.
They attempted to talk to sponsors to try to get a boycott against the station.
Yeah. You guys were vaguely dangerous.
we walked the line, as Johnny Cash said.
A little bit, yeah. Speaking of all of that, let me mention some of the other nominees. The Reverend Billy Graham is a nominee, and I'm curious about that because I know that WBT and BTV put him on the air and actually gave him the original platform from which he built the empire, but is he a broadcaster?
Well, that was the question that came up with the committee. Was he actually a broadcaster? And it was decided that his international fame as being on both radio and TV qualified him for that. He did do some things in Charlotte. Back when we were integrating the schools in the 70s, we got him to produce some commercials asking people to stay calm, and he did.
We heard from Bill Walker very briefly. He is the longest-running TV anchor in the history of Charlotte television.
I should have fired two news managers for not hiring him. The first week he was at Chapel Hill, and a good friend of mine, Billy Carmichael, called and says, guy you have to hire.
Yeah.
And I recommended him to our news director and trying not to interfere with their work. He didn't do it, and then he became available another time. We tried again. So I made a mistake in not firing two news managers.
And Doug Mays is an inductee, and rightfully so, because he was the very first news anchor in Charlotte. He was the SO reporter on Channel 3 and then moved himself to Channel 9 at some point and was in also, as Betty Feaser was, loved.
Yeah, absolutely, and very versatile. Doug did wonderful radio shows as well. And, of course, he played with country and western music guys and Doug is one of the most versatile and professional people I've ever worked with.
And then Charles Kuralt is on this list, and most people think of Charles Kuralt from CBS Sunday Morning, but he got his start, really, here in this market.
Yes, he did. And actually, we were in high school together. Actually, we ran track together, which surprises a lot of people because Charles didn't miss many meals after he left Charlotte. And when he was in high school, we ran a 100-yard dash. I could use him keeping me from being the slowest man in the state.
And I've met him several times and had a chance to spend a lot of time with him in New York, and he was a gentleman and a really good guy. Jim Babb from Channel 18, Sis Kaplan, founder of Big Ways, and Larry Sprinkle, one of the personalities there. Chatty Hattie Leeper from WGIV, all inductees into the Charlotte Broadcast Hall of Fame, which inducts its first class on Friday. It'll be at WTVI. We're coming
Thank you, Mike.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura, featuring a new fuel-efficient 2015 Acura TLX sports sedan with a 9-speed automatic transmission. New models arriving daily. HendrickAcura.com. Democratic candidate for President Hillary Clinton has turned over to federal authorities a server containing thousands of emails from her time as Secretary of State. They'll take a look at what's in those emails and how the controversy is affecting her presidential campaign coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. When's the last time you tried to make a film in 48 hours? Sounds pretty impossible, doesn't it? Well, it's been done, and the 48-hour film festival is on the horizon. We'll talk about that when we come back.
I'm Renee Montaigne. Reporting to work at midnight here at NPR West has some upsides and downsides. I mean, I'm often here with David Green, who has a very cheery morning personality, which, by the way, David, I'm not sure if that's an upside or a downside.
Let's call it an upside, okay?
Okay, we'll call it an upside. We'll add it to the plus side of getting to help you start your day. And now you can help us start our day. When you donate your old car, we'll turn it into Morning Edition. Here's how.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Most movies take months, even years, to make. The films that will be screened beginning tomorrow at the McGlone Theater at Spirit Square were made in 48 hours. 48 hours from start to finish. Hence the name of the 48-hour film festival, which features the work of local filmmakers who had to write, cast, shoot, edit, and create a musical soundtrack for their films in the course of one 48-hour weekend, which raises the question, if that's possible, how good can these films really be? We're about to find out. Will Fisher is Charlotte producer for the 48-hour film festival. He joins us now along with Julie Emmons, president and founder of Carolina Film Community. They have their own film festival, which we'll talk about as well. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. The 48-hour film festival, I was going to say starts tomorrow, but is it tomorrow or is it tomorrow and another day? Is it 48 hours of films too?
The screening is tomorrow day. There's a 2:45 screening and a 6:35 screening. We had 25 submissions this year, so we did an early screening and then we'll do the evening screening.
And Julie, you have another short film festival, the 6th annual Made in Carolina Festival, coming up in September.
Yes, that's
which
right.
Which is not too far away. Where is that?
That will be held at Studio Movie Grill, and we'll do our screenings the night of September 8th.
Okay. Is this a reminder that despite the loss of film incentives in North Carolina, that there are still a lot of people who made their living, who make their living in this business, still living here?
Yes, I'd like to think so.
And is part of what you're trying to do, both with your festival and also with the Carolina Film Community Organization, trying to find a way to keep these people here in some way?
Yeah, that's the goal, is basically just not giving up and trying to get us to a place where we're still film friendly and trying to keep people with their jobs here. Ideally, nobody would have to leave their homes to go and work in this industry somewhere else.
So who are the filmmakers in both of your festivals? Were they people who worked on shows like Homeland and Banshee? Are they hobbyists who would like to try their hand at this? Who are they?
I'd say there's a lot of both. A lot of our filmmakers, you know, cross between 48 Hour and Carolina Film Community, and I know that it was pretty intense for them this year because they were right on top of each other. We were spending, I think they had maybe a month to do their Made in Carolina's film, and they obviously had 48 hours to make the 48-hour film. They were right on top of each other. So, you know, very impressive, these filmmakers, what they've done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good cross-section. You know, one of my goals for the 48-hour film project is that this would be a platform where local artists could bring their work to just kind of see where they, you know, rank among other artists here locally. But the fact that the 48-hour film project is an international platform, it also is kind of a statement of Charlotte, just kind of where we are in the world.
How is it an international platform?
Well, the 48-hour film project is held in 137 cities around the globe. So nearly every major city has an iteration of the 48-hour film project. And the winner from Charlotte will go on to an international film festival in San Francisco in 2016, where they will screen 137 films, one from Charlotte. They will choose 12 of those films to go on to be screened at Cannes. So that was really one of the things that attracted me to this platform, is that it's really an opportunity for a local artist here, you know, to have a short track record to the world stage. And I think it can mean a lot for our city if we have someone here locally that consistently shows up at Cannes. When you look at the 48-hour film project as a platform, there are certain cities that really take ownership of this, and they prepare every year. And cities like Paris, cities like Rotterdam, Amsterdam, they are consistently at Cannes And it grows their local creative class because they get that international recognition for their city. And I think it's very possible for Charlotte to do the same.
Why 48 hours to make a whole film from soup to nuts, from conception to completion? Why 48 hours?
Well, it started as a challenge from the founder. Mark Rupert was an attorney in Washington, D.C. that went to film school late in life. And literally him and some friends from film school got together and said, hey, I got a buddy that runs a theater. You know, let's get our friends together. We're going to see if we can make a film in 48 hours. And then we're going to screen it and invite our families out. Literally the next year it became a national platform because the six films that were in the original 48-hour film project, those filmmakers moved to Austin, moved to L.A., moved to Chicago. So they went there and got, you know, more of their friends in those cities to do it the next year. And it's only been around about maybe 12 years. There's been about 700,000 people participate in this. And
30,000 films have been made in 48 hours since this all began.
That's correct, yeah.
So now, is this only possible because of digital technology? In other words, if you had to really shoot on film and edit on film and record the sound on tape and marry it to the film, could it be done in 48 hours?
Mike, I believe imagination is the fourth dimension. So if you put a goal in the hands of a creative, it's no telling what they can come up with. A lot of people say it's impossible to shoot a film with digital. You know, when I present this to some people that are professionals, earlier they called them cabbage heads. You know, I'm familiar with the cabbage heads and talking to some of the professionals here in town. You know, they say, oh, you can't do good work in 48 hours. And I just invite them to come tomorrow night to see what these people came up with, because it's sincerely nothing short of amazing.
Now, in 48 hours, you're not producing a 110-minute film. You are producing what?
It's 7 minutes. So
7 minutes.
The platform, the 48 hours, works such that on Friday night at 7 p.m., this happened at the Light Factory Gallery. Light Factory has been uber generous to local filmmakers and the community that's growing here. Literally every filmmaker came to the front of the room. There's about 125, 130 people that showed up to watch 25 filmmakers draw at random a genre of film. And once everyone had their genre, we open a sealed envelope that contains a character's name, a prop, and a line of dialogue. And it was so interesting to see a room filled shoulder to shoulder clear out in about 3 minutes because everyone rushed out of the room to start working on their films.
Is that when the clock starts ticking?
That's right, at 7 p.m. on Friday night.
So all of the people involved in shooting these films are volunteers. They're not paid. The actors aren't paid. The people who write the thing aren't paid. The people who contribute the music to the film aren't paid. The people who shoot and edit the film are not paid. What's the payoff?
It's our community. It's a statement. It's a statement of the people who live here. I think the local creatives and the filmmakers kind of got bowled over by all the political discussion of last year. But at the end of the day, you know, we're still here and we're still creating work and we're still, thinking and brainstorming and taking ownership of our local community. And that's really what the 48 is about. You know, when I had given you the notes, I said nearly 200 people come out to make films. That was before the filmmaking weekend. The final count was 287 people.
Will they all get screened?
Everyone.
Holy cow.
Everyone.
Have you seen some of these films?
I've seen everyone. I was up till 4 o'clock in the morning Sunday night watching every film.
And how would you describe the quality, the entertainment value, how would you describe them?
Nothing short of amazing. I'll tell you that the judges for this competition is out of New Jersey. One is the founder of the Golden Door Film Festival. The other two are professional directors and filmmakers. The feedback that I got from them on the initial phone call after they had watched the films, they were just absolutely blown away by the talent that lives here.
People who don't do this, who don't write or produce, don't understand that even though a film is short, it's actually much harder to do something short than it is to do long, because you can be lazy when you're long.
Well, you can develop characters, you can develop the script, the story. You know, if you got 7 minutes, everything's got to move very quickly. The plot has to develop. The dialogue has to be succinct and very purposeful of really drawing the viewer in.
And how strict are you about the 7-minute time limit? I mean, do you just stop the film at 7 minutes and
no,
that's it?
No, they have to be within 7 minutes of story to compete. So it's not necessarily that it has to be exactly 7 minutes, but if it goes over, then they would not be eligible to compete in the international. I would still screen their film.
Right.
You know, if it's 7:15, I'm not going to pull them from the screening.
How many of them stuck to the 7-minute time limit?
Everyone.
Every one of them.
Yeah.
These 48-hour film festival screenings where they take place sell out everywhere they take place, I understand it. Are you afraid that as these things become more and more ubiquitous and more successful, that you're sending a really bad message to Hollywood?
Well, I haven't heard that everyone sells out. I do know that the size of theater plays a big role in that. You know, the first year it was in Charlotte, it was in probably a 100-seat theater.
Uh-huh.
It did not sell out.
Okay.
I took producer role of this last year. And the first phone call I made was to the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. I said, I want to try to sell out the McGlowan Theater. He said, son, do you know there's 700 seats in that theater? You know, that would be the greatest show of local support for local film in Charlotte history. I said, I think I can do it. He said, well, how many people's on your team? I said, well, it's just me right now, but I can do it. And he said, nah, I'm not going to reserve the McGlowan. I made him tell me no 3 times. He said, I tell you what, you send me a proposal. I'm getting on a plane to the Tony Awards right now. I'll be back on Monday. I'll take a look at it Monday morning at 8 o'clock, send it to me. 20 minutes after I sent it, I got a call from Matt Burton at the McGlowan and said I was on. So I had 3 months to promote this thing and get the filmmakers to come out to make films. And then, you know, I didn't know going into it. You know, he told me they were planning to shut the balcony down. That way would there be 400 seats to fill, you know, in the lower level of the McGlowan. And going into the night of, we had sold 30%. So we were about 100, maybe 200 seats. And I went in to meet with the ushers and get the programs and everything. And they said, man, we got to open the house, you know. And I went, I was like, is anybody out there? And I opened, and there's almost 700 people standing there waiting to get in the theater. And, I mean, it was just magical that night.
So this starts tomorrow, though, right?
Yeah.
In the daytime.
Yeah.
Is that so that you can screen everything through the day?
That's right. So we have
How does it work? If I want to come, can I come and go? I mean, you know, how does it work?
Yep. The first screening is going to be 12 films. It's going to take about an hour and 20 minutes. So we are going to do an intermission in there. It's going to, you know, probably an hour and a half, you know, and then there'll be an hour and a half break between the 2:45 and the 6:35. We'll have the red carpet. I wasn't able to get it set up for the 2:45, unfortunately. Julie's going to be on the red carpet starting at 5:30, interviewing filmmakers and crew. as of 2 nights ago, we have a popcorn machine, so we're going to be serving free popcorn at both screenings. And, you know, we just want to make it we want to make it feel real. You know, we want the people who come there to feel really valued for their work. I mean, these people – you know, they sacrifice themselves, their lives, their family, you know, for their story. And this is an opportunity.
Well, at least for 2 days they did.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, the thing is that 100% of 2 days, you know, they didn't,
right.
A lot of them didn't eat, didn't sleep. I mean, they were literally, you know, in the zone, as they say. I mean, it's all out, just taking the next step to its furthest
point. If the clock starts ticking the minute they get their first line of dialogue, one character, and the genre, and then they have to write, cast, shoot, edit, when does how do you control when the clock stops ticking? They have to turn it in at a certain place at a certain time?
Well, it's very obvious because on Sunday night, there wasn't 130 people. There's probably 60 people. But at 7:29 and 40 seconds, we do a 20-second countdown. And so everyone in the room knows that anyone who walks in after that is not in the competition.
Wow. How many people didn't make it?
Two.
Wow, that speaks highly of everybody.
Well, these are very passionate, very very passionate people that came out. I mean, seriously, these guys are true professionals. They take their work very seriously, and you know, they believe that Charlotte has what it takes to make the world stage, and they want to step up to the plate and do their part to make that happen.
Now, Julie Emmons, your film festival is a little different. What are the parameters for Made in Carolina?
Well, this is the sixth year that we've done it, and the idea was a lot like with Will, is we just wanted to keep cultivating film and filmmaking in the area. And each year we hold this contest, and we have a different idea, a different theme. And this year we had a silent film contest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was a lot more challenging than I expected.
Are you bringing in Ethan Uslan to play piano for
you? I thought that would, that would be amazing. It was interesting to see them try to make the silent film – their own, I guess. And we had from drama to period pieces to comedy to horror, you know, just what anyone could do to make it completely silent as far as dialogue. There was music, obviously.
Right.
And then we had a prop, I guess not necessarily a prop, but you had a feature, a drawing of a flower, just so we knew you made it for our competition. And so it's a little different. It's not a national stage. It's made for the Carolinas. So it's just trying to build film here in the area. We had 12 people enter and 3 students enter.
And how long are these films?
They have to be between 3 and 5 minutes.
Well, you guys love short, don't you?
Love shorts,
you should
yes.
be doing commercials.
It's like YouTube in the theater.
So what has been the impact? Because one of your organization's goals is to keep the critical mass of filmmakers here.
Right.
What has been the impact of the loss of film incentives?
Oh, boy. The positive me wants to say, it's not that bad, we're going to be okay. But the realistic me has definitely seen a loss of a lot of our crew. Almost immediately, a good portion, I would say between 20 and 30% of our crew that was working every day in production, they had to leave. Mm-hmm. And that's been pretty awful. A lot of people were able to stay, at least for now, and I'm hoping that something will happen and they'll be able to stay longer. But the incentives certainly affected us, you know, detrimentally.
So have the – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say, you know, this it's really a greater issue of the creative class. I mean, these are people who make their living in the art form. You know, and I feel like I'm on the front lines of those film incentives, the impact of those film incentives. The reason I say that is because when I first started putting this together last year, I went and met with Beth Petty over at the Charlotte Film Commission, and she sent me with the Charlotte Production Directory. This is a directory of all the people who were in local film. So I took all the email addresses and names and contact information out of that. I had about 350. And I, you know, in order to recruit and get people involved in the 48, I've used that email list. And as best I can tell, about a third or a little more of those email me back and say, thank you, but, you know, we left Charlotte, we're down in Atlanta, we have to mm-hmm. we have to pay our mortgage and feed our family, and North Carolina is not allowing us to do that.
So the 48-hour film festival is at the McGlowan Theater here at Spirit Square beginning tomorrow. It's tomorrow only, though, right? Tomorrow afternoon, tomorrow evening.
Tomorrow well. Afternoon, tomorrow evening.
And people yes. can just show up?
Absolutely. Tickets are still available.
And the other film festival, the Made in Carolina mm-hmm. Film Festival, is in September. When and where quickly?
September 8th at Studio Movie Grill, starting at 6 p.m.
Julie Emmons and Will Fisher, thank you for being here.
Charlotte Talks with